Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig, and I want to take this opportunity to wish all our listeners a very happy holidays period.
Holiday season. Whatever's in season.
There's a lot of them in season these days.
But anyway, we wish you
they
all
come and go with some regularity these holidays.
Whichever ones you celebrate, we hope you have a good time. And at the very end of the program, we have a very helpful segment on what to do if you're baking for the holidays, but you might be dealing with people who have a gluten intolerance.
Yeah, which is increasing.
So hang in for that one. But before that,
our subject for today, is
mostly meat. Yeah, there you go. And but different variations on meat.
That make a nice title for a musical review.
Yeah. And first up, a local chef in our home city of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, who caught a lot of attention locally, but caught some nationally as well by being named one of Food and Wine's top 50 new restaurants around the country. The restaurant's called Cure here in Pittsburgh, and he is chef owner
Justin Severino. Justin Severino, you finally have your own restaurant, Cure, which has arrived in Pittsburgh to, I would say, a fair amount of acclaim, don't you think so?
Yes, so far.
Tell us a little bit about Cure.
Well, Cure's a small restaurant in Lawrenceville. It's the 10th ward of Pittsburgh. Most people in Pittsburgh recognize Lawrenceville as the hip side of town. We are not necessarily in the center of the hip part of Lawrenceville. We're kind of defined the outskirts of Lawrenceville, I think. But our neighborhood is definitely moving in the right direction. Still kind of on Butler Street, which is the main street the restaurant is on. It's really nice. But once you start getting back into the neighborhood, it's still pretty run down. I want to say I've kind of kept my eye on the neighborhood in general for a long time. Even a year and a half ago when I signed a lease here in the space, the neighborhood was a lot worse than it is now. So it's progressively
better. It's getting better. Certainly it's becoming really positively trendy. Been all kinds of national press about it. It's a neighborhood restaurant. Do you draw for more than just the local crowd?
Yeah, absolutely. I think because it's on the outskirts, we're a bit of a destination for Pittsburghers, and we get a good bit of people from out of town that want to eat good food too.
Right.
But the menu is definitely driven by what's available to us with our local farmers.
Now, you're originally from southwestern Pennsylvania, but you really went away after culinary school, and so you were more familiar with California and Northern Virginia. Tell us about some of those experiences. What did you do in California?
Well, I'm actually from Ashtabula, Ohio.
Oh, okay.
I went to culinary school here in Pittsburgh in 1998, and then my wife and I moved to Monterey, California, and my first job out there was for Marinas at Bernardus Lodge. It's owned by Bernardus Winery. Chef's name is Cal Staminoff. He's still there. And I got to work with an amazing Frenchman named Christophe Grosjean, who was the chef de cuisine at the time. It was a great place to start. They had a 3-acre organic vegetable garden, they called it, which is more like a farm. We dealt with lots of local vegetables, and there was really no food cost. We spent a lot of money on really awesome products. So it was a great, great transition for me because I worked at Casbah in 1998, and I did my culinary school internship there, and that was a great experience here in Pittsburgh, but to go from Casbah in Pittsburgh to Bernardus Lodge in Carmel Valley was pretty amazing for me.
Yeah, you have so much there.
Yeah. And then I guess after that I worked for a place called Boucher. The chef at the time's name was Walter Mansky, and he is a pretty amazing guy. I actually just hung out with him when I was in Southern California recently. I was with Big Sur Bakery. I worked with Phil Wozalowski and Manresa, David Keach, which was a pretty amazing experience.
No, he's incredible. Now, that's a farm.
Yeah. Actually, I ate there, I guess it was three weeks ago.
Really? Oh, my goodness. Yeah. I love it.
Yeah, it was pretty fantastic.
What were you doing in California? I missed that.
Oh, I did an outstanding in the field dinner on Catalina Island.
Right. Okay. Now, you've been doing this outstanding in the field for a while.
Yeah, I think this is my 9th dinner, and as far as I know, I think I've done more of them than any other chefs. But I lived in Santa Cruz for a long time while I was in California, and outstanding in the field is based out of Santa Cruz, so I became pretty good friends with Jim Denovan, the owner of the organization. And so we've done two here in Pittsburgh in the 5 years that I've been here in Pittsburgh. I did one in Virginia in the year that I was in Virginia. And it just so happened that one of my really good friends was doing the Catalina event, but his wife's due date was the day of the event. So while they were in Pittsburgh doing the event in August with us, my friend Charlie Parker, who is a fantastic chef, he called them to say he had to cancel, and it just seemed like the most natural replacement for Charlie would have been me, and I actually totally talked myself into the slot. we had a great time. It was fantastic.
So you're talking about, you're right on the mark with all the attitudes, the contemporary attitudes with produce and fresh local and sustainability and all this. What about the meat shop? And you were handling the meat program for David Kinch at Manresa?
Well, when I was there, that was my job, yeah.
What does that mean?
I definitely had some input on ordering. Although David, I don't want to say too much, David. Obviously, you know, David runs his kitchen.
Oh, sure.
But, you know, I received everything, and I basically did everything from whole animal to meat and sauce on the plate. So my day as prep would be fabricating of all the animals and parts of animals. And definitely there was that was really awesome part about working at Menry. So there was always an open conversation about the menu through David, the chef's cuisine, and the cooks. And we're all, I'm assuming it operates the same way now, just as every other great restaurant does, but there's always an open dialogue about the menu, about techniques, how to make things better, documenting all of those things. I was definitely very fortunate. It was a great time
great
to be at Manresa.
Yeah.
When I started, they hadn't had their acclaim yet. When I started, it was busy on the weekends, but about a couple months into me being there, which had nothing to do with me, but Michael Bauer gave it a 4-star review.
Oh, yeah.
The restaurant magazine called it one of the top 20 restaurants in the world. And very soon after that, Michelin was in. So it went from being this crew of very passionate cooks working really hard to try to, with a chef who's trying to make this restaurant successful, to all of a sudden this restaurant was successful. And we didn't have any prep cook. It was pretty bare bones at the time. So it's pretty amazing to see his progress as a chef and as a restaurant owner. It's been, I haven't unfortunately been able to keep in touch with him very well, but being at Manresa a couple weeks ago is pretty awesome because they've remodeled the whole restaurant. And
yeah, I haven't seen it since it's been remodeled either.
It's pretty awesome. I think that's a pretty, one of the things I took from Manresa not being a cooking technique or skill was I really, really appreciate the fact that David stays at Manresa. He could probably, if he wanted to, be a consulting chef at 20 or 30 different places and have his name on all of it, but he doesn't. He is always reinventing Manresa and making it better and better and better, and I just love that philosophy.
Yes, I do too. I mean, it's impressive. Now, you opened a meat shop yourself, a butcher shop or what?
Yeah, it was called Severino's Community Butcher. I opened it I left Manresa to open it. I made a pretty strong relationship with a farmer in California. His name was Jim Dunlop. The farm was called Taste Like Chicken Ranch.
Oh, right, yeah.
And we both kind of like took a huge risk on one another. He grew a bunch of pigs with the idea that I would butcher them and sell them. Actually, just as I was leaving Manresa, I was spending one or two of my days off butchering one of his pigs in another friend's restaurant for one of his customers. You know, he would have a customer or two customers that would buy a whole pig or a half pig. And instead of him sending it to the USDA cut and wrap facility, I would pick it up from the slaughterhouse and take it to Stokes Restaurant in Monterey and butcher it kind of after hours. They had a prep kitchen that I was allowed to use from, I want to say it was like 8 o'clock at night until about 6 in the morning.
You were really ahead of the times doing that then, too, I guess.
I mean, there was somebody else doing it in the Bay Area at the time, and they're still doing it, the fatted calf. Uh-huh. But I want to say at the time, the two of us were only two people really trying hard to make local meat made into charcuterie available to people.
So at the same time, you were doing the charcuterie.
Yeah, it's
one of your biggest, one of your strongest points. I mean, charcuterie is fabulous.
Thank you. You know, I honestly, my learning of charcuterie was just a necessity for the most. At one point, we were butchering like 6 whole pigs a week from Taste Like Chicken Ranch. And if you want to make money on a pig, and the situation in doing business in California, it's expensive, so you kind of have to. I had no choice but to use every piece and make the right decisions as to how to make those pieces worth more money. So instead of making sausage out of a ham, it would make more sense for me to make prosciutto. Or instead of selling pork belly, it definitely makes more sense to make bacon because everyone wants to eat that.
So, now, yeah. You don't have that shop anymore, right?
No. My wife and I decided to, we were kind of at a bridge in the business's career or life. Our lease was up. We just had a killer summer. We had definitely profited. And we were going to go in, you know, our business was based on going to farmer's market. We didn't have a storefront. We operated out of a communal kitchen. And we were doing like 8 or 9 farmer's markets a week. And just due to the seasons, we were going to go from doing 9 farmer's markets to doing like 4 farmer's markets. And we were going to have to tap into our profits to get through the winter. And her and I had been just recently talking about wanting to basically back to live, basically being closer to our family again.
Now, did we miss something out? But there was some place in Northern Virginia where you worked.
Well, I moved back to Pittsburgh from California, and I worked at 11. Started the charcuterie program for them, and I acted as their sous chef. And I left for a year, and then I went and worked as a product development manager for Ayrshire Farm, which is...
That's what I'm thinking of.
I think it's 2,000-acre certified humane and organic animal farm. They have a USDA processing facility on the farm. They have a chicken slaughtering facility on the farm. And they also owned a butcher shop that my wife and I managed.
Well, that's amazing. This is a huge... I hear that she's really interesting, this learner.
That would be a good word for it, yeah.
I'm going to look into that later today.
Yeah.
So, but you picked up a lot more of this information then about, sustainability, humane animal husbandry.
Yeah, well, you know, honestly, the way that my butcher shop operated, I've honestly been working, as far as my business morals or my purchasing morals or my food ethics, I have honestly been working to get back to that since I closed that business down, because that business operated as, it was pretty fantastic. We had 9 Bay Area farmers markets, which are amazing. The farmers markets out west are awesome.
Oh,
so
sure.
We did 2 things at the farmers markets. We sold products, and then we acquired like 95% of our ingredients that we'd use in our products. So instead of using sugar to sweeten our sweet Italian sausage, we would make a sweet onion jam with some local wine and some local vinegar and some local red onions. And instead of buying fennel seed, I would forage wild fennel pollen, and we would also make a fennel marmalade out of fennel that we would buy, you know, as a couple of examples. And our product list was definitely driven by products that we made in the kitchen based on what was available to us at the farmers markets. So, like, there were excess of peaches. We would make peach mustard, which then became this sausage that was peach mustard, beer from the Santa Cruz Mountain Brewery, which was a stout, pig's liver, and sofrito, which is just a way for us to preserve onions. And you see, I plan the menu here the same way.
You do butchering classes at Cure.
Yeah.
How are they going?
Oh, they're great. We actually have one this Sunday coming up.
And do you sell them out, or what? How many people?
Yeah, we typically do 45 people.
Good
just
great.
Because that's kind of what comfortably fits in the room. We take a table out of the dining room and put a stainless steel table in there for me to actually do the butchering on.
And do you whole pigs and what else?
Yeah. For instance, this week I got a large black pig from Clarion Valley Organics. The farmer that raised the pig will be there. And I kind of just go, I start out by kind of explaining my philosophy on butchering, which is not in any way like a pig is butchered for a grocery store or kind of doesn't follow the USDA guidelines for butchering a pig. I butcher a pig for the purpose of the end product, which is never the case. You know, you buy a Boston butt or a picnic shoulder or a whole ham, and I don't think, based on the philosophy of how meat is butchered in America, it's not for the end product. It's just how you can cut a pig into pieces properly, you know, efficiently. But I typically go through the reason why I cut my pigs the way I do. I point out to the crowd what the indicators on that carcass are that tell me that pig was raised in a humane environment. And then I also explain what it would look like if it came from a factory. I break down both halves of the pig into primals and one half of the pig into completion.
Mm-hmm.
We usually start out with some appetizers, which include cured meats, usually, and beer from East End Brewery, and then we usually, so what we'll do is once the demonstration is over, we clean that table up and then set out a buffet of delicious pork parts and vegetables.
Wow, that's great.
It usually lasts about 3 hours. It's one of the it's typically the best day of my week. It's one of the things I enjoy to do most.
Yeah, well, it's one of the things you're known for, certainly. You're doing a lot of, what do you call it, guest chefings, too?
Yeah, we did. Well, when we first opened, we did 2 a month, and that was kind of my way of PRing myself at the time. We haven't paid for any advertisement, so that was kind of my initial way of just getting the word out there.
Well, you're well known. You're certainly well known. You're not exactly a shrinking violet.
Thank you. Well, not to mention, I love doing it. You know, I think there's so much inspiration, and you get like a. I get a real sense of accomplishment. Well, like, I guess I feel really good about what I do when I get to work with my peers. It's different than running a kitchen and telling people what to do and how you want something done. Like yesterday, David Rascott from Notion and I did a dinner. You guys were there.
Yes.
And it's usually a Sunday. We've both had a long week, but it doesn't matter how tired or run down you are. It's inspirational in most cases to get together with another chef and talk about a menu and plate it together. You know, two different styles colliding and becoming something
even
better. Oh,
yeah, totally different styles, yes.
Yeah.
So, and you're doing something in New York coming up, I guess?
Yeah, the 14th of January, David Santos just opened a restaurant called Loro. He and I just spoke today briefly. We're starting the creative process for what the theme of the dinner is going to be. But he, pretty awesome restaurants, I want to say he was a sous chef at Per Se for a little while. And then he's been doing a dinner club out of his house for the last couple of years and just had this fantastic Kickstarter. He just did like a $60,000 Kickstarter campaign or something like that.
You know, it's like a wide open playing field, Justin. I mean, if you would sort of home in on what you think your next step would be, what is it that you would want to do differently?
What we talked about with David Kinch, I really am interested in keeping Cure evolving to be something better. I don't know that I have it in me to manage more than one concept. I'm not interested in it. Based on, like, built this restaurant with a couple of my best friends, I picked out all the colors, the textures, the wood. Designed it to be, I like to think that it's a bit of a reflection of who I am. Like, the space, the menu, it all makes sense to me, and that makes me feel really good about it. And I really don't know if another space or another concept would make me as happy as this space does. So I'd like to think that I can spend my days here at Cure for a long time.
Oh, well, that's great. We certainly, you get a lot of that loving back when you have your guests in there. So, well, as usual, I love talking to you and getting your philosophy. I think a lot about what you're doing, and that's something that's wonderful, I think.
Well, thank you.
Yeah. So keep thinking.
I'll try.
Keep butchering and keep making that charcuterie. So,
thank
Justin, thanks for talking to us.
Thank you, Ann.
And we'll be back with another point of view about meat right after the break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. And next up, I think you really need to have this book by Bruce Adels on your shelf for quick reference. It's called The Great Meat Cookbook, and believe me, it's great.
Now,
and
of course,
he's a character, and he's wonderful.
Because that assumes you're not a vegetarian.
Right.
In which case it would
you wouldn't
be,
buy this
in,
book.
In which case it would be an excellent doorstop. But other than that, not really a great value, because this is about meat with a deep voice.
Welcome the prolific Bruce Adels, and by that I mean books, in case you wondered, Bruce.
Just wonder which way you were going with that, dear.
Yeah, well, dear.
Are you prolific too, Bruce?
I don't know. Not in terms of procreation, no.
No, this book is called The Great Meat Cookbook, including expert advice on sustainable meat. So that's, you're giving a certain twist. But what about, how is this different from your last book, which was The Complete Book of Meat?
Well, you know, poor choice in titles, because once you title a book that way, it's very hard to follow it up with anything else. But the truth is that when I wrote that book, which was back in 1996, things were different. First of all, there wasn't much of an internet, and people weren't aware of issues related to how animals are treated, raised, fed, and things like that. Thanks to people like Michael Pollan, who wrote a number of articles in the Omnivore's Dilemma, people became way more aware of these issues. So I felt it was really time to readdress some of this. And the fact that I had accumulated many hundreds of recipes in those 16 years, I really wanted to share those. So brand new recipes, new information about some of the issues that concern people, such as sustainability, and discussions of new types of meat that were new to some people, the bison and goat. I added some recipes for that as well.
I love goat. It's so hard.
Yeah, it's really good.
It's hard for us to get it here, actually. So I loved right from the beginning, your sausages, and that was a long time ago, right?
Yeah, that company started January of 1983, so it's about to have its 30-year anniversary.
Wow.
Still going strong?
No idea. I left there about 11 years ago.
Oh, okay. So
yeah, I was wondering if you
still... part of a large sausage company called Hillshire Brands, be known as Sara Lee, and they changed their name recently.
Oh, really? I didn't know that.
They unloaded most of their other non-core businesses, which included underwear and stocking.
Well, Sara Lee doesn't really sound much like a name of a company that would make sausages, does it?
No. They still have the Sara Lee brand of cakes, but they also had a large bakery division, and they sold that off
that was,
as well.
Yeah.
Yeah,
well,
so they're sort of concentrating on their core business, which is actually sausages and cured meats.
I never knew that. But now, similar things are happening to your friend Nyman, right?
Bill Nyman?
Yeah.
Yeah, Bill sold his business, so he has the same problem I do, that somebody else owns his name.
Yeah.
In my case, they own my image as well, at least as it existed, you know,
oh, really?
20 years ago.
Oh,
yeah, but Bill is doing really well. In fact, we had a couple of his turkeys for Thanksgiving. He's doing all free-range meats, turkeys, and beef,
oh,
all grass-fed. He's doing a great job, actually.
Non-compete is over, huh?
Well, yeah, that's pretty different. He calls his company BN Ranch.
Uh-huh, okay.
Well, let's get back to this book, because it arrives at the perfect moment for people to get that ultimate Christmas or holiday gift, right?
Absolutely. It's a big book with about 100 photos and over 200 recipes, plus all the information about making choices as far as purchasing choices. Yeah, and it's a $40 book, so that's a fairly expensive, but a book that'll last the rest of your life.
Yeah,
I think the information is going to remain relevant for quite a time, as the previous book, which is still in print it came out in 98, so 14 years.
Quite a number of things have changed. Can you identify some of the most important ones?
So the list is, people are concerned with how animals are treated, particularly being fed. This is in relation to cattle being fed in tight places called feedlots, and that upsets a lot of people. And pigs being confined to cement houses and fed that way. I mean, people just have made the choice that they don't want to support that, so they're interested in animals that are actually out in the pasture and allowed to sort of behave as nature originally put them on the planet.
But what does that mean in terms of a recipe?
In terms of recipes, when beef is finished on grass, often it is leaner. It doesn't have to be leaner, but it all depends on the nutritional content of the grass. So leaner meat needs to be cooked a little bit different. It cooks quicker, and if you overcook it, it can really dry out. So I do have specific recipes for grass-fed beef, and then bison, which is already a very lean meat. It doesn't marble very much at all. It would pretty much treat the same way as you would grass-fed beef.
What is sort of the go-to book for people to understand what all these terms are that are being thrown around all the time? Natural,
it's very confusing. Some of these terms are meant to be confusing, and one of them, the most confusing, is a term called natural, means zero. All meat is natural. It just means it's minimally processed and doesn't have any artificial ingredients. So all meat would meet that criteria. So it's absolutely useless title, and it's disappointing that the USDA allows the use of that term.
Well, what do you think? I mean, what about what they're doing to the definition of organic?
Yeah, and it gets confusing. People think organic and natural are synonymous and they have nothing to do with each other. The USDA, what people are more concerned with is how the animals are raised, and they do have a term called naturally raised, which is defined as animals that are not given any added hormones or antibiotics in their diet. They have approved that term, but they don't use it. They don't allow anybody to use it on a label, and I have no idea why that is. Very hard to get a straight answer. I wasn't able to get one. So it's really upsetting for me to have terms that are useless and confusing. It just makes consumers distrust their government.
Well, I chuckled reading your little chapter here on Wagyu beef, because the word really
another
means
one,
cow.
It's pretty special if you've ever had it.
It's
highly marbled beef. They come from originally from breeds of Japanese cattle. The Japanese word Wagyu just means Japanese cow. it doesn't actually refer to the breed, but there are specific breeds that have this high propensity to marble. And I guess the most famous are the breeds that are used in the prefecture of Kobe.
Yes.
And is known as Kobe beef, which is a protected name in Japan. It does bother me that in America we use this term American Kobe, which is a misuse of that term. However, the stuff that's available here, which is usually crossed with Angus, is still wonderful and very highly marbled.
I was told that the reason that they crossed it with Angus is because the Angus make good mothers and the Kobe don't.
Right. Yeah, that's
so
what
they
I was
do
told.
A lot of switch, whatever you call it, transplanting of fetuses and things. it sounds really technical.
Now, Bruce, did you introduce any new herbal or spice combinations from the previous book?
Oh yeah, I would try to cover the globe. So it really, cooking meat is all about seasoning. So I have a lot of new recipes for rubs, marinades, pastes, brines. One of them that I really love is one that has gotten to be really popular. It's a rub for steaks, and it has a little bit of ground dark roast coffee and a tiny bit of cocoa powder in it. And you don't really taste those things per se, but they give this beautiful crust to the steak and just gives it kind of complements the flavor of the steak.
Well, we buy something called char crust that seems like it does the same thing. Do you know that one?
I don't know that one. I'm not really a consumer of commercial rubs because I make them all myself, but yeah. I don't know that one.
It was actually developed by a restaurateur in Chicago.
A chef.
Uh-huh, yeah.
And
a lot of the chefs have really gotten into these rubs, which is great.
Let's turn our attention to, I thought this was a really important section. You have instructions on using this book, because that was really at the basis of the whole concept of talking to you about it, is how are people supposed to use this book?
Well, one of the things I've done on every recipe is I've grouped them into sort of keyword features. So a typical feature might be a recipe fit for company or a dish that can be cooked really quickly, which I call in a hurry, a dish that can rewarm well or makes great leftovers. And you can actually go back to the index, and they're all speeds that come under each of those categories are grouped together, which is really helpful. And then I've also, in each chapter, kind of grouped all of the similar recipes together. So if you go to the beef chapter, all the steak recipes will be grouped together. And that would include whether they're grilled on an outdoor grill or finished off on a broiler or what have you. All the roasts are together. All the pork chops are together. And then all the pot roast recipes would be together. So it makes it kind of easy. You just start with the table of contents, and you can go look through the list of recipes. Or if you're in a hurry, you just go to the back of the book and look at all the recipes that are easy to make quickly. So I think that's helpful.
I like your recipes labeled meat as a condiment. I think that's very on trend for how people are eating nowadays.
Well, in the rest of the world where they really can't afford to eat big old slabs of steaks and stuff, meat is often used as a flavor component and only small amounts, typical of Asian cooking. And I get to Italy a lot, and a lot of times you'll see just a small amount of meat used in a pasta sauce, soup, or even a stew. And you're right, people don't necessarily want to be eating huge portions, but they want that flavor, and so that's why I've got that category.
Now, this one I'm looking at, this recipe, I was really impressed. You have the chickpeas tucked in there, the casita from Castilla.
Is that one of the Spanish recipes?
Yes, from La Mancha.
Yeah, that's actually the national dish of Spain. People think paella is, but it's not. That's the Spanish version of a boiled dinner. It's called cocido.
It's wonderful.
And that version is the one they eat in the area around Madrid, and I actually was lucky enough to go there on a tour, a press tour, and so that's the result of some of my travels. And you kind of, the basic flavor component of that is a leftover bone from a Spanish ham, a Serrano ham, and that's where you get a lot of the flavor. So you also save some of the trimming, some of the skin that you trim off that.
Wow. And the other thing that I think is very useful is that you have a section after each recipe for alternate cuts of meat.
Absolutely, because I wanted to cover, my mission in this new book was to make sure I covered every single cut that you could find, and that's not necessarily in a grocery store. A lot of people are buying their meats from farmers markets and through CSAs and things like that. But often if you do have to go to a grocery store, you may not be able to find a particular cut, so I want to make sure that you still find cuts in a grocery store that will work almost as well in the recipe. So that's why I always have alternative cuts in every recipe.
Well, I think that's going to be very useful for people, especially when they're trying to monitor what they're spending on meat And I think they're kind of going in that direction, too.
Yeah, you hit a very important point. Because of the huge drought, second year now for Texas, the largest beef-producing state, the price of beef and pork especially have already headed up. I think beef's up about 30% from last year, but we're just seeing the tip of the iceberg. It's going to take a long time, and that's assuming that we actually have some decent rain next year. It's going to take a long time before those prices come down, and my guess is they're going to continue to go up.
People have just been shrinking their herds because there's not enough water and feed.
That's the first result of a drought, is that you have to reduce the size of the herd. And so that makes less animals around. Once that happens, so it's plain old supply and demand, basic principles of economics, and that's exactly what happened. The fact that you have to charge more for the meat because you're paying more for the basic feeds.
Right. I think that you go into such detail in this. I can just see this on every cook's reference bookshelf in the kitchen.
Well, I hope so. I really tried to be, since I wrote that other book, The Complete Meat Cookbook, it kind of positions me as an expert, and I feel obligated to help people as much as I can to understand what it's like to buy and enjoy meat. So that was kind of my goal.
Yeah, it sort of jumps out of the pages at you that you want to really help everybody.
It's my nature. Unfortunately, I'm a scientist, got a PhD in biology, and have taught cooking classes for the last 20 years. It's in my blood. What can I say? I can't help myself.
This is a recipe we're going to have to try, pickled beef tongue, because Peter collects beef tongue recipes.
Well, yes. Assuming I can find, buying beef tongue is the hardest thing to do, though. It's really hard to find.
Yeah, you need to go to ethnic markets. It's always available if you have any kind of Hispanic community where you live.
Unfortunately, that's one community we don't have a lot of.
That's true.
We have.
Well, that's too bad. Often Eastern European too. It's really enjoyed in places like Germany, Poland,
right?
Places like that. Of course, there's mail order sources as well.
Yeah. But I really cried reading about the lamb's tongue. You know, because you can't get that many lamb's tongues. There's only one per lamb.
Right, you have to kind of get somebody who freezes them and buy. And those are really inexpensive. All the different animal tongues, that's probably most delicious and the easiest to cook with because they cook pretty quickly.
Yeah, well, we love the salad, the lamb's tongue salad at Babbo.
Right,
me too. Mario called the Jamesons. They have an organic lamb farm nearby here. And he wanted, I forget how many thousands of them a week. And you just can't, you know, for an artisanal producer.
They didn't have a herd that was big enough, that's for sure.
No, that's
a
for sure.
A flock, I guess you would describe it. Right? He would have decimated his entire flock just to keep Mario and Lamb's tongue for a week.
There you go.
Okay, Bruce, now tell me this. If you have a last word about this book for our listeners, what might it be?
Well, my last word probably is what. Hopefully you'll buy one, and when you do, you might want to keep it by the bedside because there's some pretty good reading in there, although you might suffer like I did when I was writing this of getting very hungry. That's the problem with writing cookbooks.
I know.
I can picture that, having sat reading it, I can picture that, and eating something less satisfying than...
You know, getting up at 2 in the morning to cook yourself a steak probably isn't the most...
You didn't.
Convenient activity, but I think it's going to make a wonderful gift for anybody that's the least bit interested in meat, and it really is going to be certainly a cookbook, but also a reference, and I hope that people find what I have to say to be clear, and I can't say I can clear up every issue, but I certainly try to do my best.
And you've done that with conscience.
And then the wonderful thing about it is that it's big enough to help you reach the cookbooks that are on the top shelf.
There you go. Yeah, you can always stand on it. It's a heavy book. I think it weighs about 5 pounds.
It would be good for making brick chicken.
Exactly.
Bruce, we hope the cash registers go jingle, jingle, jingle between now and Christmas with people stocking up with the Great Meat Cookbook. Thank you for writing it, and thank you for joining us today to talk about it.
It's great talking with you. Thank you very much.
And don't go away, because we'll be right back after a short break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
And here we are again, and the next book we're going to be talking about has a really concise title. It's called Lard. You might find it rather surprising. The author of the book.
I think you'll find it very, very interesting.
Yes, very interesting. And the author is Hank Will. And he tackled this as your grandmother's secret ingredient. And, you know, if you think about it, it was.
He's into four letters, isn't he? Hank, Will, and Lard.
The subject of today's interview is something that Peter grew up on, and Anne certainly didn't grow up on, the wonderful fat called lard. Who can imagine that someone would go out of their way to write a book on this subject? But Hank Will did that, together with colleagues from Grit magazine. Welcome, Hank. Welcome to On the Menu. I understand you are running sheep today, though, not pigs.
Yes, that's true. We've been working sheep today, but we'll be working pigs in a couple weeks.
Now, did you grow up on a farm, Hank?
I actually grew up in a family, a nursery and seed company family in North Dakota, but we had friends and neighbors that raised animals around all around us.
Oh, boy, you grew up in North Dakota. Oh, wow. Yeah, I mean, that's the flattest place I've ever been in my whole entire life.
Oh, yeah, it's flat and the wind blows, and boy, it's cold in the wintertime.
It is cold, yes.
And Hank, you're the editor-in-chief of this magazine called Grit.
That's correct, yes.
Tell us a little bit about that, first of all, because it's a somewhat unique kind of name for a magazine.
Yes, Grit is a venerable name. It was founded in Pennsylvania in 1882 as kind of a good news rural newspaper, and over the years it evolved to where it is today, which is a bi-monthly color magazine that's pretty much devoted to what we call the rural lifestyle. That includes even urban homesteaders and folks with small holdings and whatnot.
Does it include people who have chicken farms in their backyard?
Absolutely. We're huge proponents of the backyard chicken movement.
Now, did you happen to see the Today Show just a couple of days ago had a selection of the gifts from the Neiman Marcus 2012 Christmas collection, and one of them's a chicken farm for your backyard?
I know. It's quite something else, isn't it?
And
yeah.
you saw how much they wanted for it.
I think they wanted $100,000 for it, right?
Right. You could probably get a Grit magazine subscription.
Yeah, for life, probably.
and still pay a little bit less for your chicken farm.
Well, I mean, it is incredible. I mean, Neiman Marcus used to do his and her airplane. You know?
Right.
So it shows what things are prized in contemporary society.
I have a feeling they missed the mark there somehow. I have a feeling that
how
somebody...
How much did they offer for that dinner with those six celebrity chefs?
Well, that's reasonable. People who read the Neiman Marcus catalog probably are into that.
Right.
Whether they're into having a backyard chicken farm, I doubt very much.
I know. I mean, I'll be really curious to see if some sell.
some sucker will buy it. If Ringling of Ringling and Barley and Brothers Circus is to be believed, there's one born every minute, so I guess somebody will buy one.
That's right.
And in the meantime, for slightly less than $100,000, you will undoubtedly be happy to supply the happy prize winner with a lifetime supply of lard.
That's correct.
I grew up with a mother who she made wonderful pies. She used Crisco.
Sure.
Not even butter, mind you, but Crisco.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, that was bad news when they decided it was bad for you, this trans stuff.
Right.
But Peter, of course, was raised in the north of England, and I was there, and his mother wanted me to make a pie, and I was totally appalled that what you use for a fat in pie crust over there is lard.
So, oh, yeah.
I had never used it my whole life.
You want your pie crust to rise really well.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think
that's
great.
What you use. But let's admit,
that's a long time ago. Now I understand lard, especially since reading this book called 100% Natural Lard. And I also am a great fan of lardo, actually, which we tasted in Italy years ago.
Oh, yeah.
And you became a fan, too, having originally been rather disgusted at the idea, as I recall from looking at your book.
You may not have written that.
Oh, no, I didn't write that part. That was from Casey Compton.
Oh, okay.
When she first tried it, I think she was abhorred at the thought of it, but then when she tried it, she rather enjoyed it. I actually grew up with lard, not lardo, but I'm the guy that would eat the fat on his pork chop rather than trimming it off.
Oh,
like
absolutely.
That.
I mean, your proper pork chop
has
the skin on the outside.
Oh, yes.
And has at least a quarter inch of fat inside that before you get to the meat.
Making me hungry.
Yeah, we're going to visit my brother in far southwest of England Christmas time.
Oh, fun.
And I already know one day on the menu will be pork chops with the kidneys in the center and the right amount of fat and the original skin on the outside. Which is something you can't buy here.
You're not going to get your sister-in-law to cook lard.
Well, my brother, no,
she'll things in cans.
Well, first of all, she doesn't cook anyway. My brother cooks, but we will undoubtedly have pork chops sometime we're there because it's pork that tastes like pork. But let's make sure that to begin with, a lot of our gourmet listeners undoubtedly have traveled to Italy and have tried lardo. And obviously lard is a root that comes from the same place. But
correct.
Draw the distinction between the two for us, just for those people who don't know.
Yeah, I think the best way to think about this is that what we call lard in our country, in the United States, is basically the fat that surrounds the kidneys, preferably anyway, what we call the leaf fat, and that it's been heated to actually render the fat part from the protein.
Right.
Whereas lardo would be intact fat, sometimes taken from the back, sometimes taken from the belly, and it's typically fried, I think.
And it's cured first.
It's cured first, right? Exactly, and it's intact. It still has the connective tissues. Those flavorful protein bits are still networked throughout it, but it cooks up to just this sort of delightful, delicious stuff that I think is really hard to resist.
Yeah, I think most of what we've had has just simply been preserved. It's been smoked or it's had some kind of process like that.
It's been cured, right?
cured but not cooked. And that's I actually think that's some of the best kinds of charcuteries and whatnot. Which really I would think of lardo as being a member of.
Oh, sure.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
Where they're cured and aged, and then you're good to go right after that.
You're on a mission to do a variety of things with the grit. But this book was one of those.
Yeah.
No, absolutely.
Well, let's talk about it. I mean, it's subtitled The Lost Art of Cooking with Your Grandmother's Secret Ingredient.
Yes.
And it's true that it would be very hard to get the same results, particularly in baking and frying, if you did not use lard, right?
Yeah, no, that's absolutely the case. Especially when you think about, pastry making, before about 1950, it was probably almost exclusively with lard because that was really the shortening that was available, maybe some butter. But I think what a lot of folks, and that's sort of carried over, to today, a lot of folks don't realize that it's also a great frying medium because it has a very high smoke point and a relatively high burning point.
I was surprised by that, but I read that in this book.
Yeah. So at my house when I was a kid growing up, there was, lard would get used maybe three or four times for frying, before my mother would decide that it was spent. She would filter it with cheesecloth, but and then it would be solidified and fed to the wild birds.
In
the wintertime,
they need
a suet block.
So in other words, you kept reusing this lard.
Yeah, for frying when she would fry with it. And she typically wouldn't use stuff that she'd used for frying when she was baking. She would use, fresh, virgin lard, if you will, for pie crusts and cinnamon rolls and those kinds of things.
No, my mother used to do the same thing. She didn't use cheesecloth. We had a special sieve.
Oh, cool.
For taking the burnt bits out of the lard.
Yeah.
And then indeed we would use it over again.
Right.
Where did you keep it in the refrigerator?
No, we didn't have a refrigerator.
No, ours was in a can right next to the stove.
Yeah, that's what.
No, in our case, things like that were kept in the cellar, or basement, a lot of houses had a stone table in the cellar, so you could put things like that on the stone table, and even if it was 80 degrees outside, it was still only 50 degrees. On the surface of the stone table.
Sort of like
I love that.
Is that like my Uncle Frank's, what do you call it? The
spring house?
Spring house.
Well,
yeah, the spring. I was going to say, we used to store some stuff in a spring house.
Yeah. But there's always those awful spiders.
A spring house gets you to the same point.
Yeah.
It gets a reduced temperature.
But I used to hate having to get the butter out of the spring house.
You don't use any electric energy or any other kind of energy.
Right.
I love the stone table. I think that's a great, were those native stones?
You know, did they, or were they coming right out of the ground?
No, great big flagstones.
Oh, neat.
In the form of, I mean, it takes you three. One at each end and one flat on top.
Oh, I love that. And it was typically installed in the cellars, so most cellars would have one of a certain period anyway.
That's right. Yeah, exactly. That's the whole idea. So, I mean, my parents didn't have a refrigerator until they were probably 60 years old.
Oh, golly.
Your family still doesn't refrigerate a lot of stuff.
Well, my sister keeps things in it. She has one of those storage freezers, those block freezers that open on top.
But the refrigerator itself is pretty tiny because you put a lot of stuff in.
It
also traditionally never got very hot. We'll see what changes once we have climate change.
Well, they had climate change this year in England
for sure.
All the grapes died before they ripened.
Oh, goodness.
But anyway, back to the subject of
you
things.
You have some really interesting, I'd say quirky, recipes in this book. I'm looking at this one. French fried cucumbers. Now, what is that? I mean, cucumbers, as you say here, are 90% water.
So I know, but if you get the breading on them just right, you know, the one really cool thing about lard is it gives you that beautiful golden crispness really quickly because you can get it, you know, plenty hot. And it's a great way to use up extra cucumbers, which sometimes take over our gardens here.
Oh, okay. Well, now Peter's going to, he has a special box grater that he loves, so he's going to be making this potato latke recipe. I can see it. We can get some lard.
Well, I make it now, but I can't use lard because we don't keep it in the house.
Yeah.
But we may have to correct that.
Get that. Yeah.
I'm sure Whole Foods probably stocks it.
Of course, Peter uses bacon drippings for everything.
Yeah,
bacon drippings.
The bacon drippings are good too. But did we explain that Hank's in Kansas?
No, I don't think we've talked about that yet.
I guess we never did say that. But you were raised in North Dakota.
Yes, I'm actually from North Dakota.
But
I would have been a fourth generation person in my family line anyway in North Dakota.
And
I just moved a few states south, you know, so I could bear winters.
Oh, so you were escaped the cold, the freezing
yeah.
cold.
Although the summers in Kansas are fairly warm, too.
Oh, they're long and hot.
You know. Yeah.
I said we lived there.
The thing that sticks in my mind about Kansas is as you drive the Kansas Turnpike between Topeka and Wichita, there's a sign that says you are entering the Flint Hills, and it's a good job there's a sign because you wouldn't otherwise notice it's a hill.
Yeah. You know, the prairie is very subtle in its changes.
So what brought on the subject of lard? Who had this ingenious idea?
Oh, you know, it was one of those wonderful sort of group collaborations. We had a department meeting with the grit editors and our publisher, Brian Welsh, and, you know, we were kicking around ideas for ways that we might actually use this huge, multi-year database of recipes that we have that are from, you know, folks send to the magazine.
Oh, they send recipes to you.
Yeah, for years and years.
Why?
We have a department in the magazine called Good Things to Eat, which is, you know, people will send in a question saying, oh, I'm looking for a recipe, you know, such and such high-rising biscuit that was called Grandmother's Sky High Biscuits or something like that, you know.
Uh-huh.
And then we'll have a whole, that'll be published in the magazine, and then we might get several hundred variations on somebody's grandmother's recipe of biscuits coming in. And we put all that into a large recipe database. And we've done this, we've actually archived these things since the 20s.
Wow.
And we have some hard copies of the recipe prior to that. You know, obviously, I wasn't working on the magazine back then, but we've got this deep, deep sort of cultural resource. And so it was actually our publisher's idea to take an ingredient and an old-fashioned ingredient at that, at least old-fashioned for the United States, and then try to build a book, a cookbook around that.
Now,
you know, it took us just a few minutes, and he threw out the concept of lard, and as soon as he did, we all went, oh, absolutely, because it's one of those, you know, lost ingredients, an ingredient that had been vilified, certainly in this country, for really no good reason, other than to make some other kinds of things profitable. So we did that. We put together a proposal and then floated it by a couple of different book publishers, and you know, it gave us a great sort of partnership with Andrews McMeel Publishers.
They have a lot of quirky books, by the way.
Yeah, it really fit their, you know, they were really excited to do it, in part because it is unusual, you know, and we thought we would get actually lambasted for putting together such a book, but you know what, we've just had an outpouring of positive support and thanks for being, you know, they say being brave enough to put our name on something that sort of flew in the face of mainstream.
I don't know. We have one book, part of a series by this one cookbook author called Fat.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, and she also wrote one called Bones. And what was the third one?
I forget. It was another one-word title.
Oh, I love it.
If you go to Amazon.com and put in Bones or Fat, you'll get the name of the author. I can't recall.
I'm going to do it.
Now, just very quickly before we close.
Yes.
You tested the recipes then, so you selected recipes, and then you tested them.
Yes.
Style.
Yes, my wife did much of the testing, and she actually, you know, we have a few where the handwritten directions were kind of hard to understand or hard to read, and she would, you know, render them into a more modern set of measurements, you know, where somebody would say, and enough flour to make a soft dough, she would actually say how many cups that needed to be.
I have several books with relatives' recipes written like that.
One last thing. If listeners are interested in joining the Grit family,
yes,
is there a website they can go to subscribe?
Yes, we would invite them to come to www.grit.com, and they can get all of our stories online there, and they have several opportunities to subscribe at deeply discounted rates.
Great. Well, you're getting ready to go herd some pigs tomorrow, so we better let you go. But Hank, Will, thank you so much for joining us today on the menu. It was so much fun talking to you about such an interesting subject.
Thanks so much for having me. It was really my pleasure.
Okay. Thanks. Bye, Hank.
All right. Bye, guys.
Congratulations to those of you who are patient enough to wait for the gluten-free baking secrets coming up right after the break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
And next up, my Twitter buddy, actually, Jean Sauvage, is somebody you're going to listen to because she is authoritative on the subject of gluten-free, being gluten intolerant herself, and she's also dealt with a child who has a peanut allergy, so she's very careful about what she does, researches everything thoroughly, so she's sure she's got the answers. So here up is...
And especially, we might add, focused on treats that are typical and loved for the holiday season.
Yeah.
So,
and she insists, you'll hear her talking, that they taste as good as you want them to taste and remember them as. Jean Sauvage. Well, you know, the social media stuff, I think, really does work because a whole mess of books about gluten-free baking picked one of my Twitter buddies. Jean Sauvage, congratulations on your book.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, I'm OTM Dish, by the way. I don't know if you've seen me on Twitter.
Oh, yes. How fun. I love that.
Yeah, I do too. So you have a very timely book. It's Gluten-Free Baking for the Holidays. And, of course, you're right on the mark of something that's the major problem in the United States, probably in the world at this point, huh?
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Yeah, and I don't personally understand how... it all happened and everything snowballed, but there are many, many people who have the same problem that you were diagnosed with, which is gluten intolerance. And it's hard. We just had some plastering done, and our plasterer, who's, I guess, in his mid-30s, was also just diagnosed with gluten intolerance. And he's on a learning curve that's really tough. He wasn't used to reading labels and also very expensive. He found a place with a gluten-free bakery in town where he could get the flour, but it was outrageously expensive.
Because he can afford it better than we can.
Well, of course, he's a plasterer. He did. Yeah. But now, tell us a little bit about the background of this.
Yeah. I was diagnosed personally after the birth of my daughter in 2000. It turns out that if you're genetically predisposed to gluten intolerance, something that's a, quote, a trauma to the body can do it. So pregnancy, childbirth, a really bad illness, an auto accident can trigger something like this. And so when I had my baby, I also had gluten intolerance. And it is a very high learning curve. It's something that I think doctors are probably getting better at now, but they basically tell you, okay, you can't eat gluten, see you later, and you're kind of left trying to figure out, well, what can I eat?
What's gluten?
Gluten is a protein that is found in wheat, rye, and barley, and that includes any form of wheat. So that includes spelt and kamut, emmer, einkorn, farro, durum.
All the good grains.
Yeah. Well, no, these are all particular wheat. They're in the wheat family.
So it's open wheat.
Yeah. So,
you're okay with quinoa.
Quinoa is okay. That is not in the wheat family. So grains that you can have are things like quinoa, corn, rice, amaranth, buckwheat, sorghum. So there are actually a lot of things that we can have. It's just that our society uses wheat for so much that it's in so many things, and that's what gets it just is challenging when you're all of a sudden told you can't eat any of it.
Especially when you're a devout baker, as you are.
Exactly. It was really a tough diagnosis for me because all of a sudden what I heard was I can't bake anymore. It just felt like I had this passion taken away from me. And it took me about a year to kind of go through the mourning process and finally kind of pull myself up by my bootstraps and try to figure it out. It takes quite some time. And eventually I figured it out, and more and more ingredients and flours became available on the market, and I found that actually it's quite satisfying, and I can create just about anything that I'd like that tastes and feels just like their wheat counterparts that I remember. But I so remember how hard that first year was.
Yeah, well, Shauna Ahern has done this too.
Yeah. She had hers was triggered by a car accident. So
the same
kind of MO.
Now, what do you have to do differently? You start out with a thing, I guess, it's so obvious you wonder why everybody else didn't think about it, which is you just have to make a different kind of flour.
You do. The problem, I think, or the challenge is that most gluten-free bakers have determined that no one flour will substitute for wheat flour. So you have to kind of change the paradigm a little bit. And so what I have done, and what many gluten-free bakers have done, is I've made a mix of flours that then I use cup for cup in my recipes as the flour.
Yeah, here's the recipe here with brown rice, white rice, wheat rice, and tapioca.
And xanthan gum. And xanthan gum is what we call a gluten replacer. It's the thing that is missing in gluten-free flour. It makes sense, but you often don't think about the fact that you need to replace that very important ingredient. And gluten is the thing that is a binder in recipes,
right.
It's a structure builder in recipes, and it's elastic so you can mold your cookies or cakes or whatever. And that's the thing that most gluten-free baking that's the biggest challenge, is how do I replace it in a way that will mimic wheat flour?
And you actually could do this without losing flavor, because I have to be perfectly honest, most of the commercially done gluten-free baked goods that I've had have tasted like iced cardboard.
Oh, I agree. It's terrible. It's getting better, to be honest with you, but I honestly don't understand what is going through the minds of the commercial manufacturers. It's almost as if They think that we've lost our taste buds in addition to our ability to digest gluten. That's been a really big challenge for those of us who are gluten-free. And one thing I've done in my book, the thing I strive for is to make sure that my ingredients taste and feel like their wheat counterparts. So basically, they're like the things I remember growing up for the holidays.
So you started out with a set of things that were traditional for you and your family and friends and the holiday season, and said, how can I make these without using something that is important to the structure or whatever of them called gluten?
Right. And I also quizzed my Twitter followers and my blog readers and the people on Facebook and asked them, what do you miss over the holidays? What did you have growing up or even as an adult that you would really like to see gluten-free? And I included many of those in my book.
Well, they seem all to be here. I mean, cookies, you have all the biggies, the, what do you have, the, what are those? Pfeffernusse, whatever they call it.
Oh, the Pfeffernusse, yeah.
And you have arugula. You have even fortune cookies, Mexican wedding cookies, which is one of my favorites, shortbread, gingerbread. I mean, you have all that. And then you move on to cakes. You have fruit cake even, and Bûche de Noël. How did you do Bûche de Noël?
Bûche de Noël was much harder to develop than I thought it was going to be. As you may know, the base of a Bûche de Noël is a Genoise, which is an Italian sponge cake. And it took forever for me to get the right ratio of eggs in that particular recipe because, as you know, you need to roll it. And one thing that gluten-free baked goods do not excel at is they are not as elastic as their wheat counterparts. So figuring out a Genoise that was tasty in addition to being rollable took quite some time. But once I figured it out, it's been terrific. It's such a hit. I've been bringing it to various demonstrations because people get so wowed by it. And it turns out to be a very simple cake. You just have to not be afraid to kind of get your hands in there and roll it up into that log shape.
I don't know how you get your head around chemistry enough to be able to do this, to be honest.
Well, I'm a little bit of a nerd. I have a PhD, and I used to be a professor in my former life. And so I like to research, and I like to experiment. And so I just went to all of the food chemists. There's a woman out there named Shirley Courier. She wrote Bake
Wise. Oh, I know Shirley, yes.
Cookwise, yes. So I read all her books.
And she's a genius, too.
She's terrific, and I took a session with her at a conference, and I learned so much. And I also read Harold McGee, his book, and I just kind of devoured any information I could find on the science of baking, the chemistry of baking, and then I kind of sort of reverse-engineered it for gluten-free baking. I just kind of figured out what it was that was happening with the gluten baking, and then I needed to kind of translate that into gluten-free baking.
Wow. Do you have anything, do you sell anything, or just recipes?
I don't. There have been times in my life where I've made various cakes or cookies or things for people, but I find that where I really get a lot of joy is teaching other people to do it. So I would prefer to teach you how to make it versus me making it for you. So that I finally discovered that that was more my forte.
And so, I mean, you don't sell your flour, which I think would be fairly lucrative.
I don't yet. At some point, I think I'd like to look into that because I get so many people who would like to buy it pre-made. So that when I get some time in the new year, I think that's something I'll look into.
You have pies, tarts. How about donuts? I mean, wouldn't that be tough?
You'd think so, but they're really not that hard. I have three donuts, actually, in the book. I have pumpkin donuts, which are a cake donut.
Jelly.
And then I have sufganiyat, which is the traditional Hanukkah jelly donut.
Mm-hmm.
And then I have the struffoli, which is an Italian kind of donut hole type of thing. And they're all pretty straightforward, and the only hurdle people need to kind of get over is their fear of oil. A lot of people are afraid to do the deep frying, which is what each of these donuts requires, and it's actually very straightforward. I mean, if you just follow the directions, you come out with a terrific fried good. And the other thing about frying something like this is it doesn't absorb nearly as much oil as people think it does, so it's the health component of it is not as bad as I think people think they are. They're not like French fries that are sopping in oil. They're just fried, and they immediately crisp up, so they're not absorbing all of that oil.
Well, this is going to rescue a lot of people for the holidays if they rush out and get this book fast enough. And, except they should already be baking, shouldn't they?
You have a few weeks. I know Hanukkah starts next weekend, so that's the first one to prepare for.
Yeah.
Great. Well, I bet you're baking already, and thank you so much for joining us today, and we'll let you get back to the stove.
Oh, thank you so much. It was my pleasure.
Yeah, I was trying to talk to Shauna Ahern about the cannoli shells, and she was very impressed that my family put pistachios in the shells.
Ooh, yum.
Yeah, I know. Anyhow, go to your stove, Jean Sauvage, and enjoy the holidays.
Thank you. You too. Happy holidays to both of you.
Thank you. Well, as I said, Jean is one of my Twitter buddies, and you should follow me on Twitter. It's called OTM Dish is my handle on Twitter. And as Peter reminds me, I'm lagging behind the Pope. So get on the stick and on Twitter.
Yeah, but a lot of his tweets are critical, though.
He only had one tweet he came out with, and he has a million followers.
Yeah, but most of them don't like. Well, let's not go into that.
Yes,
on
right.
The air. Let's be peaceful for the holiday season. We wish you, of course, that again, and we hope you'll join us next time. Same time, same place.
Bye-bye.